Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Unfiltered Fitness Radio. Today, I have Dr. Alyssa Olenek with me. Alyssa has her PhD in exercise physiology. And not only that, but she does some pretty badass stuff, both in the gym, on the road, on the trails, and is a hybrid athlete and has just a very empowering message, I think, for women about being strong and chasing after big goals. So we're going to talk about some of those big goals that you might be chasing and a little bit of science as well, because we both love it. I think that's actually, I mean, you know, I started following you back when I was in graduate school at USF getting my master's in exercise science. And then we finally met up briefly at, was it ISSN in St. Pete 2021. Yeah. So a long time ago now.
A while ago now. Which is funny because I interviewed and almost did my master's at USF. But I was going to do it under Kirkpatrick. But then I met Campbell and I was like, man, Campbell would be a better fit from like my interest, which I met him there too. I'm a big fan of Bill. And I think my career wove its way where it was supposed to be eventually. But that was like one of my top choices for my master's too. And I ended up not going there, but I did visit at one time. So we might have, no, I think you're younger than me. So I probably visited before you would have been a student.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I started 2018.
I was in my PhD at that point. So it would have been three years. Yeah. You were still an undergrad. Yeah,
okay.
I'm dating myself a little bit. I don't think I'm only like 2 or 3 years older than you though.
Yeah. So
probably just a little bit ahead of your time.
Exactly. So, well, and speaking of that, so give me a little bit, I mean, I know we could do a whole podcast on your education, your background, like your journey to get your PhD, but I'll let you kind of intro yourself and maybe a little bit about like what made you decide to, you know, pursue, I mean, your master's and then, you know, your PhD and a bit about what you're doing now before we dive into it.
Yeah, I'll give the truncated version because I did catch myself on some of my earlier podcasts. Like I have like a long story, right? And no one really actually cares. They just want to know what I can tell them. They don't actually care about me. So long story short, I grew up an athlete. I fell in love with running. I played lacrosse and ran cross country and track a little bit. And basically, as the story goes, that I wrote on my grad school application, I was 13. I started running because I just, in my head, I was like, this will make me a better athlete. And I fell in love with fitness and like the potential of our body. And I thought it was incredible. And I just remember being like so immature in my thought and thinking like, this is amazing. Like I want to share this with everyone. Everyone needs to know about this. And I still have that passion with a little more practicality for human application now as I get older, but I really chase that. I love sports was like my whole identity. I wasn't into school. I wasn't super nerdy. I didn't even really think or identify as smart. And then I went to college to play lacrosse. And that's where I kind of like accidentally found out that I was good at science and I liked science. And I like just fell into it. I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna fail out of my science classes, had a million tutors. And then I was like, oh, I'm good at this. And I wasn't so good at lacrosse when it came to college. Like I wasn't bad, but I definitely had, I joke, I had the highest GPA and the lowest playing time. And so eventually I left after 2 years. You know, I was still pursuing my degrees. I found out that you can do research. And then I found out you can get graduate school paid for. And I found out that I didn't just have to be like a glorified fitness trainer, that I could actually like be an exercise scientist. I had no idea that was even a thing. And I was just like, I just felt like all these doors open that I didn't know were possible for what I wanted to do. Cause I thought I was going to have to do like PT or PA or pharmacology. No, there's nothing wrong with those things, but I loved exercise. And so, you know, discovering there was a whole science to it was incredible. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go to graduate school. So I did, I graduated early, did an internship, got my master's, then went and got my PhD. This is my master's where I started to do like metabolism and female phys stuff. I carried that with me to my PhD, kind of brought that with me. I did my doctorate work in, I still continue to do research on women, a lot of it in human metabolism. So postprandial metabolism or post-meal metabolism or exercise metabolism, sex differences or birth control, or menstrual cycle stuff. And then now I'm doing a postdoc in menopause to kind of get the breadth and depth across that lifespan. Still with a metabolism and metabolic health lens. That's a lot of my, you know, my bias. I joke my bias comes from the fact that I view the world as not only a trained exercise physiologist, but like also as exercise as a tool for health at the end of the day. So that's like where my biases lie. Like that's how I just view everything. And so I've just kind of continued this path of learning as much as I can. And it kind of foreshadows backwards then of being a female athlete and then now being in this position I'm in now. And yeah, I I'm obsessed with sports and science and fitness. And I am kind of merging all of those loves into one in my career now, finally post, you know, graduate school. And it's been really fun to, you know, see that dream kind of come to volition almost, what, 18 years later at this point in time, which is super crazy to think about. But that's like the long story short of how I got here.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I mean, your passion is like, I'll, you know, link all your stuff in the show notes, but like on your Instagram, I think it's, you know, super clear. And I mean, more research on women, you know, I mean, that was not, I mean, now it's like, I feel like becoming more of a thing in the last, well, and we know too, like the studies that we're seeing aren't necessarily the studies that are being done right now. They're what were done like 5, you know, 10 years ago. But yes. I mean, like, I think it's just cool that like, again, like, you know, through your time, like undergrad or getting your master's and your PhD and now like really kind of, you know, giving that platform or giving that space, you know, in science to kind of study, you know, more women. And I know you talk about like women aren't that complicated. Like we don't, it doesn't have to be complicated. Is that like something that you've had to navigate at all, like with like your PhD as far as like studying women? Cause you know, for our audience, like, you know, people don't know, like, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's because we have a menstrual cycle or even birth control. Like a lot of times, like women have been shut out of research because it's just one extra layer to that design process.
Yeah, luckily, I think there's a lot more like call to action or reducing the barriers of including women, because it's like this double-edged sword of like, we need higher methodology and higher quality studies so we can start pulling back like more answers to the things that we want to know, because the incongruencies in a lot of the data we have comes from this like mix match of methodology or not clear methodology. But we also don't want to like make more barriers to people like doing research on women. But it is more steps. It is potentially more effort, more money. I figured it out. My hot take is I figured it out as a PhD student who had $2,000 to do her dissertation. So I think it's just lazy that people like aren't including, you know, females in their studies, at least alongside males. But it's because you have to control for the menstrual cycle, which extends the timeline of your testing. You have to test for ovulation potentially. You know, there's more participant burden, and or you have to like confirm hormones, which costs money, and you need lab access to do assays. But like, honestly, in my experience, for my premenopausal, my birth control people, and the menopausal and my postdoc, I mean, there's some things you have to jump through, but women are really, really willing. And like, I had no issues, really. I think I had like, in my entire dissertation, I think I dropped 2 participants, and I was like in a crunch and a rush. And I was just like really amazed by how willing and flexible these women were to do my study. Even the menopausal women in the study that I was like working on in my postdoc, they're like, I'm never going to benefit from this data, but I want to be a part of it. And I was like, that's incredible. Like, we want this stuff. And so, yeah, it is messy. There's more things like, there's a million types of birth control. So it's like, everyone wants to know exactly what their exact birth control does. And it's like, well, there's like 7 trillion types and classifications on hormone profiles. So it's not like every study is classifying every single one of those. And I my biggest thing is like, I think too many people in the social media are too quick to like be like, researchers are ignoring us, they aren't studying us. And I'm like, no, they are. There is data on us. They are studying us. The work is happening. It's just not at the same prevalence as maybe like non-female specific stuff, or you know, stuff that was done in males. There is sex gaps. We published that in our Invisible Sportswoman paper in 2021. And we're doing our follow-ups on all that. But it makes me frustrated, because it's like, this work is hard. People are doing it. There's not known data, you know, and it just feels like a backhanded slap to researchers that are trying to advance this field and do this work, because it's, science is slow and it's not sexy and it's a lot of work. And hopefully we will see more stuff come out with the pushes and calls for action by, you know, people greater and establishedness and just knowledge and, you know, tenure in this field than I am. But, you know, being on the frontier of the online space, kind of fighting this, I'm like, you guys are shitting on sports scientists who are actually like, they're not the problem. We're on your side. And it is frustrating. And I also, you know, there is the hot take I have internally with academia is like, if you aren't including women in your studies, it's kind of lazy. But there's even niches and areas in our field that there's more female prevalence than males. Like dietary interventions and fat loss studies get way more female participants than male participants. And women are actually, in my experience, more willing to participate for studies than males. So researchers just need to make sure they're asking the questions, or like, we need grant funding or university support for different things that, you know, require this and flexibility. And yeah, there's a lot of things that go into it. So I have both like criticism and grace for science and academia for like why it's not happening, but also like, okay, like we need to like lower the barriers at the same time.
Yeah. Well, nuance, there's nuance, which we love that.
To everything, right?
To everything. And that's Dr. Campbell used to always like comment about how females were easier subjects and like you were saying, like easier to recruit. And that was definitely my experience in the lab. And like you said, eager too. And I mean, I know my listeners, you guys are eager too. But like you were saying, like eager to learn, like, you know, ovulation strips and testing for ovulation and to learn more about their own physiology, for sure. And I think just social media in general, like we're just confused. There's so many voices and it's like, who do I listen to and what's, you know, going to really move the needle for me.
Yeah.
So, and that's, I had so many things I could potentially have talked to you about on this episode.
Yeah, I know. There's so many things.
So many things. But what I did want to kind of start with and focus on is hybrid training, because I don't know if it's just my Instagram or the people I follow, which I think this is awesome, but I feel like in the last, like, or maybe it's just this year, 2024, or the last, you know, year or so, hybrid training has becoming more in vogue. And women, I feel like, are less afraid to do cardio, or less afraid, you know, people in general are less afraid to combine cardio with their weight training if they have muscle building goals. And people are also just seeing the health benefits of having cardio, you know, vascular activity in place. And it's not just we deadlift 15 reps and oh, it's cardio. So that's all great. But I think people are also still very confused still about either how to include, I'm going to stick with running. You know, I think that's kind of the main, you know, activity that people are looking to add in. But people are either confused about how to add it in, or they're worried that it's going to negatively impact their health. Cortisol is a favorite hormone that's thrown around in this conversation. Hormones, sex hormones in general, like, is it going to, you know, disrupt my menstrual cycle or impact my fertility? Like all the things. So let's maybe start with, what do you think somebody who is listening should know about, you know, say they're lifting right now, you know, they have a solid, you know, weight training program. What should they know if they're curious about adding in some running into their program? You know, maybe they want to improve just their overall fitness. They want to kind of feel more like an athlete. How would you tell them to kind of, you know, look at their programming and what to start with?
So first of all, I love this intersection of like my two like little knowledge and expertise, because it's like a fun, I don't know, everyone just wants to talk to me about the menstrual cycle stuff, but I'm like, yeah, but like, let's talk about like some of the cool, fun integrations of like what you can do. So love that intersection there. Two, I think that, you know, when we are thinking about adding cardiovascular activity on top of what we're already doing, especially if we're thinking about like women and hormonal health and the cortisol boogeyman that we all are literally living in fear of, like everyone's cortisol is spiked because they're afraid of their cortisol spiking. Like, I'm pretty sure that that's a phenomenon that's happening right now, right? So the biggest thing is, one, you know, I recommend, you know, everyone, but especially females, is don't look at this running or this cardio you're adding as a fat loss tool. I think that's a big mistake women make, is they only view and have a relationship with cardio as a tool for fat loss, or they associate it with like energy burning and calorie burning and fat burning. And think of it more as a performance tool, just like you're lifting. You progress it, you periodize it, you balance intensity and volume across the week and time. Think of it as a fitness tool, just like you're lifting. I think people assume like cardio is just 30 minutes, do whatever you want, burn as many calories as possible, repeat again, feel frustrated, boring, hate it. And it doesn't have to be that way, right? You can use cardio as a tool of fitness, just like you can everything else you're doing. So one, be intentional with it. Don't just start slapping a ton of it on, doing some random stuff. Like, you know, ease in, build up slowly, volume, then intensity. Don't start doing a ton and making it really high intense all at once. You know, we get a lot of, I think the hormone-y circles or the lifty bros all dunk on cardio because they don't know how to program it. They don't know how to ease into it, and they don't know how to manage that volume and fatigue. So like, don't just start slapping a ton of things on top of your programming, right? Start with just building up volume and frequency and keeping it lower and easier intensity. As you kind of ease in and adapt to it. I mean, if you're relatively fit, you can jump into moderate to higher intensity stuff at first. But if we're thinking about like recoverability and adapting into it, like it's okay to start with like easier, frequent, recoverable stuff. Like that's the zone two thing that's really trendy right now. And then one of the things that I think people make the mistake of is they just start slapping it on top of what they're already doing. Pull back your lifting volume a little bit. I know that can seem really scary for a lot of people, but you really only have so much that you can recover from in a general week of training to begin with. But also, it's going to be more fatiguing because it's novel and you're adapting to it, and it might end up feeling like your lifts are going to, you know, get impacted. So either use RPE to adjust for some of that fatigue and I know it will go away. Don't freak out if the numbers go down a little bit in the beginning, or pull back volume just a little bit so you have that space or time you need to recover from that within your week. It doesn't need to be permanently, because the idea is over time with hybrid training or all training is you build the volume capacity of what you have. You're raising the floor, some people say, or I like to say, you're putting more water in your bucket that you have to like put into multiple things. And so don't be afraid to pull back or let progress feel like it's stalled for a little bit as you adapt to that new thing. That's normal. It gets better with time and you adapt to it. But make sure you're maintaining a amount of training that's recoverable, right? We don't want to be doing so much that we're just like trashed all the time. And then two, when you're adding that cardio to your training, you know, start with doing it, like increasing like maybe 2 or 3 days a week, keeping it easy. And then once you kind of get consistency, then bring up maybe one of those days or more intense. Or if you're not doing a whole bunch, maybe two or more intense and the rest is easy kind of thing. I think some people try to like add like 4 HIIT workouts a week or start doing like a ton of this stuff all of the time. Again, ease into that. I like the volume before intensity thing. And then because then you maintain the volume when you're ramping up the intensity, right? It's kind of like if you just started doing 5x10 back squats when you were doing no back squatting last week, you're going to blow up a lot more than if you just started like doing, well, let's start with 2x10, right? And then like we eased in versus like 2x10 and then 6x3 in the same program or something crazy like that. Like think of it in terms of what you would your weight training. Like you wouldn't just throw a beginner into doing one, like cluster sets of, or like one rep maxing, right? Similarly, you don't need to be doing that in your cardio programming. And so from there, I also think a really important thing for people is the nutrition. People are so afraid to eat carbs. They're not ingrained and trained to eat carbs as a tool for performance, especially in lifting, because while you do need carbs to support your lifting, you just don't need as many carbs in your diet to support lifting like you do cardio and endurance training. And you need to eat as much carbs that supports the level of activity you're at. People, when I say eat more carbs or emphasize carbs, people think that I'm trying to tell everyone to overeat their calories, drive up carbohydrate, and make yourself insulin insensitive or give yourself metabolic disease. And that's not what I'm saying. But there's a linear relationship with volume of activity, especially cardiovascular activity. You know, lifting is part of this equation of components too, that it's a linear. The more you're doing, the more hours or minutes in a week, the more your carb intake goes up. And you're not just like storing that carbohydrate. Your body is using it for energy to either support you in the moment to like drive metabolism so that you have energy to do the activity that you're doing, or it's using it to store and replenish and refill your glycogen stores in your muscles and your liver in between sessions, or it's getting pulled in from your bloodstream into storage, but then it's being used during recovery. So it's not like it's just like going straight into your fat tissue like people like to think it is. It's being utilized by your body, but that will help with recovery. That will help with fatigue. That will help stop any of the killing of your gains, right? Because you have adequate nutrition. And we're thinking about women and females. You know, when people are worried about cardio with your hormones and cortisol and all of the things, you know, one, carbohydrates bring down cortisol. They decrease that response. Two, we are very sensitive to energy deficits, whether that's within day or across days or over time chronically. We don't want to be in these like acute energy deficits because that is low energy availability in the acute time period. And three, low energy availability also mimics and parallels or similar to that of low carbohydrate availability, which can kind of be a form of low energy availability. And so especially females, not only are you sensitive to these large energy deficits that you might create with cardio and then not match with adequate replace food intake or recoverability in your training, you know, but then when you have this low energy availability, cardio is more stressful on your body and you do have a heightened cortisol response, and or your hormones might be suppressed or downregulated or dysregulated because of these things. So you might have anovulation or luteal phase deficiency or amenorrhea that comes in response to these things because you have this match of heightened stress, heightened activity, and low energy intake. So your body's kind of preserving yourself and protecting you. But you can add these things to your training in a way that's, one, using recoverable low intensities with intentional high intensity work spaced in. Two, eating to support it. And three, gradually easing in. So you're just not like, I think people run into the problem when they start just like throwing on 5 days of like a ton of cardio and all this with like not adjusting their nutrition and they're still lifting at the same capacity. And then they're like, oh, cardio destroyed my hormones or cardio, like, you know, killed my gains or cardio didn't work for me. But you have to be systematic with it and you have to eat to support it. I need to eat more when I'm training for a race than when I'm in the off season and I'm just kind of lifting regularly and, you know, doing training passively. And that's just that flux of energy intake that you need in response to what you're doing. And so those are some of the biggest things that I, you know, recommend to people is one, pull back volume or like a little bit slightly while you adjust, give it time. Two, systematically build volume and intensity gradually so you can adapt, right? Cardio takes time to adapt. It's going to be fatiguing. Do it little by little. And then three, eat or increase what you're eating in order to support that. Maybe don't start a deficit at the same time you start adding in cardio simultaneously, giving that double whammy. You know, you might end up losing fat to begin with from adding the cardio, but you want to make sure that you're like matching that intake influx, especially if you still want to have quality lifting sessions. You need to match that with adequate carbohydrate intake because that will decrease some of that fatigue or interference or the things that we are worrying about.
Right. I like that you touched on lowering the lifting volume or intensity. And I think that's something that people for sure forget about is, you know, it's just all the focus on the cardio and what to do there versus like, how does this impact, you know, my training as a whole? And nothing is permanent, right? Like, you know, like Alyssa said, like you pull back, say like a month, you know, ish, and then you ramp it up again, or, you know, a couple of days a week, you know, ramp it up again. And then the carbohydrate thing. Yeah, for sure. I feel like, and that's, I mean, what so many of women's fears come down to is it's not that exercise directly caused a hormone imbalance. It's that lack of energy available and that equation being out of balance that led to, you know, some issues. So yeah, that's, I think the biggest thing for people to kind of drive home with the carbs and even like fasting. That's something that comes up for me a lot with women is they're training fasted. And for weight training, I feel like I don't really recommend it, but you can get away with it depending on the training intensity, the training volume, and, you know, your total carbs across the day, you know, what you ate the night before, your post-workout meal. But as far as like running and fasting there, what are your thoughts there? Because my understanding is low energy availability, and then you mentioned low carbohydrate availability. Fasting can be part of that.
Yeah. So there's a lot of pushback on the idea of women fasting because you know, rightfully so, there isn't a ton of data on it in women. So, I mean, lack of data doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's not good. I mean, we do have data that fasting in overweight or obese women, at least classified by these studies. I know people get mad when you classify things like that, but just based by the studies, it does improve things like metabolic disease or diabetes or weight status. And I think for like maybe potentially weight loss individuals, that's maybe more urgent and more important to drive that energy deficit for these changes. So it can be potentially a tool for metabolic health. I don't think it should be written off entirely. But we also know from other data that fasting is really no different than controlled energy deficits otherwise. And I'm of the stance, if you're going to fast or you're going to have a non-eating window, to just end your eating window at the end of the day earlier rather than doing it in the morning. I think there's even some other data coming out on that now too that makes it, because insulin sensitivity and all these things are like, they're lower at night. So it would make more sense to like pull back at night instead of the morning. And so if people want to fast, I usually recommend doing that. Like just stop eating after dinner rather than like, it's just easier for people to not eat breakfast or wake up or roll out the bed. And I get a lot of pushback for suggesting people eat at least carbs before training in the morning. And I know that's really hard, but you know, these acute within day energy deficits are still considered low energy availability by our body. Even if you're eating enough or even more than enough, you know, you have some people who are like, well, I'm overweight or I'm like not losing weight, so clearly I'm eating enough. But even if you're fasting and living off coffee and a whiff of air all day, and then you're overeating at night, you're still in an energy deficit or low energy availability during the day or during your training. And so if you're just doing like a passive lift or maybe a little upper body session, maybe not even lower body day or some yoga or walking, like, yeah, you probably don't need to eat and you'll be okay. But if you have a lot of volume or a lot of intensity, or you really want to make the most out of your training sessions, I highly recommend people at least eat some carbohydrates. And I know people hate this advice, and I recommend it for like lifting as well, because carbohydrates are protein sparing, and that will help with some of that breakdown of your protein for metabolism from your training session. Like if you can get some amino acids in, it doesn't need to be a lot, like even a little bit. Like I drink a glass of chocolate milk. It doesn't have to be dairy. Like use soy and or whatever, just like juice or a little half a protein shake. Or, you know, I usually recommend to people, even like applesauce packets are so great. People give so much resistance to this eating thing in the morning. And I'm like, no one's asking you to get up an hour earlier and eat a full digested meal. Like take a couple applesauce packets or like a half a scoop of protein. Or, I mean, I honestly prefer you to get in some carbs even over just the protein. That's why chocolate milk is like usually recommended as something really easy, because you can just like drink it. But, you know, my take is like, we don't have this concrete data on fasting for how vocal people get to be against it. But I also think that if you're highly active, you have any sort of fitness goals, and or you are training to improve fitness or doing high volume, high intensity stuff, you're working out for maybe 45, 60 or more minutes, you should have some food or fuel in you. If you're doing like 30 minutes and it's maybe okay, you know, but I really do think that even having a little bit in you is highly recommended to most people if you're exercising in the morning. Again, you might not die, but it might not also be ideal. So, but it doesn't need to be like maybe 30 to 60 grams of carbs in before your workout. And again, that seems like a lot. Saying 60 grams of carbs to a lot of people seems like a lot, but that's kind of in line with the recommendations of like 1.2 grams per kilo of body weight or lean mass if you're a larger individual potentially before you train is kind of the suggestion. Now, that's probably more on par for endurance or large bouts of cardio, versus like if you're lifting, you might 30 grams might be fine. You know what I mean? 50 grams, whatever that looks like. But yeah, my take is if you're training with any sort of intentionality, you should have something in your body. And it doesn't need to be dramatic. And also you can train your gut to tolerate food in the morning. Trust me, Sarah knows, she's followed me for a long time. I had the most wrecked stomach ever from stress in my PhD. And I had the lowest tolerance to eating in the morning. I used to get sick before runs and trail runs, and things would make me sick all the time. And now I eat before everything in the morning, even as early as 4 a.m. It is possible, but it does take time and practice and figuring out like what works and sits well with you.
Yes. And experimenting, you have, like, I feel like a lot of people that push back, at least for me, are like, they haven't even tried it or they haven't tried it recently. And it's like Alyssa said, you got to try and start slow. Start with the 20 grams of carbs, start with the banana. You know, it's okay to start slow, but you got to try it. You don't write it off completely. So yeah, I mean, we're definitely same page there. And I mean, yeah, like you said too, a lot of people who do fast in the morning or fast before training habitually, they tend to eat more at night. Your hunger signals are just trained to that, right? So we have to retrain them to be, you know, hungry in the morning and, you know, not still digesting your meal from last night. But yeah. And then you touched on upper body days versus leg days and eating. And that made me kind of think of too, as far as structuring runs during the week. And I think people get caught up with like programming too, because they just get so narrowed in on a week, like, but a week is something we made up, you know, time as humans. And you can kind of think bigger picture than that. But practically speaking, how would you recommend somebody starting? Like, let's say they were on an upper lower split. Let's say they're training 4 days a week, or we'll do a lower upper split, 4 days a week. How would you recommend like leg days and running? Like, would you put it on an upper body day or got to play around with it? Or what do you see to work best?
So my biggest thing with most people is like, there is no perfect hybrid training split. That's usually my disclaimer, but there's things that we can consider that are like more optimal versus less optimal. And I know optimal is like a word being tossed around nowadays. First things first, the most important thing is that you get it in, right? Most of you, I love to say, you're not fit enough to worry about that. Most people aren't so fit that they need to like, that you're going to mess it up so badly that it really matters. Like getting it in matters the most. But for a lot of people, what they struggle with though is that lower body fatigue and soreness. And so the next thing to say is like, nobody died from running on sore legs or fatigued legs. if your soreness is chronically like a 5, 6, 7, 8 out of 10, something's off in your diet or your training. You need to either pull back, you're doing too much, your lifting's too novel, or you're not eating enough to support what you're doing. If that's like chronic, the first few weeks, again, that's why we pull back the other stuff, right? So you can have the recoverability, you know, and then from there, if you're doing like an upper lower 4-day type split, I usually recommend, there's two camps, right? It depends on how much cardio you're doing also on top of that and how long. So for most people, if you're doing like 20 minutes of cardio, like a 2 or 3 days a week, you can put them after any of those days. It doesn't really matter. But if you're training for something like a race and getting more specific, you know, there's usually the camps of put it on your leg day, keep your hard days hard, keep them fatiguing, just put them together versus, okay, well, you can put them on your upper body day. And my take is, how many rest days are you taking? So right now I lift 3 days a week and I'm running like 4 or 5 days a week. And I usually have one rest day and one upper body day. And on some weeks I mess up and I have to run on my upper body day, but usually then I'm giving my legs like 2 days off per week. But if you're taking 2 full rest days off per week, then it probably like doesn't matter where you're putting those runs versus lifts, because you're still getting that recoverability on your legs. But for some people, it's nice to just put it on their leg day, because then they're getting the break from their legs entirely on their upper body days. There's also the like, you can, this is where it's like, it so depends, right? Because some people like to put their speed work or their quality sessions or their hits on their legs days. So you're doing like the hard with the hard, but there's also the benefit of like, let's do that hard workout on its own. So maybe you're doing legs Monday, upper body Wednesday, hit Wednesday, lower body again Thursday, Friday, upper body long run Saturday, and you're spreading them out. Or maybe it's the legs on Monday, upper body and the speed workout on Tuesday, legs are totally off on Wednesday, legs again Thursday. You see, like, you're spreading that volume and intensity across your week, putting your other easy day in there after that, upper body day, give your legs a break, then your long run on the weekend kind of thing. So there's different ways you can manage this, but usually I like to just kind of spread that volume and intensity across the week and making sure that you're giving your legs a break. You know, beginners might need more breaks or more space between those things. More trained people might be able to do a lot more intensity and volume back to back to back, and it'd be okay and kind of handle that together. I personally, like, if I'm in like my off season and I'm taking 2 full rest days, I usually kind of, sometimes I'll do cardio on an upper body day, not really worry about it. But now, right now where I'm doing more, I'm usually doubling up on leg days. I like doubling up on leg days and then having that extra upper body rest day. Similarly, I also have the suggestion for a lot of people, if they start adding in more running or more cardio, is I think a lot of people come from the world, and this might be more of your audience, of like doing bodybuilding splits where they're doing 4 or 5 days a week of lifting. And it's like really scary for people to pull back. But what if you did 3 of really high quality sessions and then you made that space for the other stuff in your week or the recovery? I have a 4-day a week program and a 3-day a week program for people. And it's hard for me to convince people to do the one that's 3 days a week. That's like purposely pairing with knowing you're doing a lot of cardio. And so that's one of those things too, where like, if you're doing an upper lower split or a push pull split, which I think is totally fine and awesome, I mean, that's a great classic split, is that if you're starting to have a hard time managing all that lifting on top of, you start getting down that hybrid hamster wheel and you really get into it and you're doing more than just the exercise guidelines, you're doing more than 2 to 3 hours of cardio a week, you start doing 4, 5, 6 hours of cardio a week, and you're like, oh, this is really hard to manage all of this, then maybe you're pulling that back. But then maybe you're someone who can handle a lot of volume and you can double up multiple days of the week, and that's okay. It's just like, don't get in the habit of thinking more is better, because better is better. And so sometimes the most helpful thing I can tell people is pull back and just make sure you're really keeping the quality of that there, and so that you have the time to do the other things and also recover at the same time. So I know that's like not a direct answer, because it really depends, because the beginner I'm going to recommend is doing less lifting and cardio or running overall, where the intermediate and the advanced, they could do more of both and recover and handle all of that concurrently. And then again, it also depends on like the split and the type of training that you're doing. Like, yeah, you could probably get away with the bodybuilding split, because some people lift 4 or 5 days a week, but they're doing like these 30-minute bodybuilding split workouts, which is very different than like if you're doing like a 3-day a week or 4-day a week, like strength and hypertrophy combo type, high intensity type program. So what I usually recommend is, you know, if you do them on the same day, lift first, or separate them by 3 to 6 hours. I'm team put your leg day on your speed or hard workout or running day if you can't put it on its own day kind of thing. Use your upper body days as rest for leg days if you're training like 5 or 6 days a week and you need that in your training. But if you have multiple rest days per week, you can kind of just do things on whatever day you want to do them. And it's probably fine just keeping them on separate days. And then that's kind of like my titrated approach of like, how are you going to line this up and pair this in your week? Because there's like, I think my hybrid ebook has 70 examples of how you can do this based off people are beginners.
I was just going to plug that. I was going to say, yeah, like yeah. We need a whiteboard, but like, I know you got some awesome programs. Yeah.
No, and I know that's not a direct answer. And that's so, people always want, they're like, what's the best hybrid split? And I'm like, one, how much can you do in a week? How much do you literally have time for, right? Mm-hmm. Then from there, I have a post on this that kind of breaks it down for people to like build their split. Then how much can you recover from? Then, okay, let's lay it out in a systematic way across the week to manage that leg volume and fatigue, but also getting it in. Like if you guys are doing 20 to 30 minutes of cardio after a lift or running, like, and you're only doing like 150 to 200 minutes per week, you're probably fine. Like no matter where you're really putting it, it's when it becomes more technical when you start adding more and more and more. Or for the people who have like low fitness in one or both, and they have low recoverability and they kind of have to just take a step back in order to step forward. And so, you know, there are those minute details that might matter more, but it's really just depends on where we can put things, right? So that's kind of like that. That's like that awkward, like, okay, I can't give a clear cut answer because we have hundreds of clients in my programs and they're doing all of my programs and they all have a different training split and a different training week. And I think that that's almost like the best reassuring thing I can give people is like, it doesn't have to be perfect. And even me, my schedule is really haphazard. I don't even follow a consistent split every single week, but I keep similar components. Like I always keep my long run on the weekend. I always do my back-to-back training on the weekends. I run on Mondays because it's easier for me to do a run after my runs all weekend and then keep like be recovered for my leg day on Tuesday. Tuesdays are my back-to-back or double day. Wednesdays or Thursdays are either upper body or rest or vice versa. And then Fridays are usually another full body or leg day. And I'm usually doing one other run or cardio either on, usually I try to do it on that extra leg day, or sometimes it's on my upper body day because that's just like how I'm going to get it in. And it gets trickier when you only have one rest day because you're just trying to like manage this all everywhere. But that's where increasing your volume as you can recover from it also comes into play.
Yeah. And like there's seasons for things too, right? I mean, like you were kind of touching on like, okay, if you sign up for the half marathon or, you know, depending on your fitness level and your goals, like the 10K, the 5K, like maybe like that's where you shift your focus. And it's okay if the weight training drops down to, you know, 3 days a week and or 2 days even, you know, it doesn't have mm-hmm. to be perfect either. I think, yeah, optimal, like that damn word. But I mean, optimal is ultimately about like the person in front of us. And it's about what's optimal for you and your goals and optimal for you right now would be different from even training for the same thing like 3 years ago, right? It just is different.
Yeah. And that's why like I joke like what I say for my programs is it's like hybrid on your terms, because I feel like a lot of the thing with hybrid getting really trendy right now is it makes it seem like there's one best way to do it. And there's one size fits all approach, but everyone has different spectrum of their goals. There's a big difference in someone who's like, my main goals are weightlifting, but I'm just adding in cardio for health and enjoyment and just like, you know, not to die. And then the cardio endurance junkie who's adding in lifting for injury prevention or because they know they need it versus the person trying to optimize like both of these things at the same time, all those people's weeks are going to look different, right? Like my client who's a busy mom who is trying to run and lift is going to look a lot different than my single, like dual income, no kids client who's training for an ultra and still lifting, you know what I mean? On top of it, like all those people's hybrid are going to look different, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why like the limiter is not so much like your perfect split and balance. It's usually your time and what you can actually do. And that's where I like, you know, I have that big seasons approach, because it's like when you're lifting and focusing on building muscle and lifting, don't get rid of the running and cardio, but like you're just dialing up the one and dialing down the other. And the same thing, if you're starting to add running or you want to run a race, you know, don't death grip your lifting. You can pull back and still maintain a lot. The biggest mistake I see people make when they do that is they get really black and white wishy-washy and they either give up one to do the other, or they lose that intensity and the intentionality of their training and they kind of go through the motions. And I'd rather you do less, but of higher quality, especially with lifting, if you're pulling back, because that quality is going to give you more of the stimulus than just doing a lot like mediocrely across the mm-hmm. week. Like I'd rather you do two or three really high quality lifting sessions than four or five where you're like fatigued or rushed or you can't get it in, or you're only hitting like RIR like 5 on most of your lifts. Like, think about what allows you to get the most quality. And I think a lot of people, maybe not your clients specifically, or like your, but I'm sure you see this, they come to you doing way too much lifting volume to begin with, let alone when you think about doing it alongside all these other things. And that's a really hard thing. I have a lot of clients who are very fit and they have these high volumes of fitness or history status or athletic backgrounds. And I'm like, honey, you are just doing too much. You do not need to do this much to do both. I think that's like the biggest mistake I see with hybrid training is people think that you need to do, like, you need to train like a full-fledged, full-time bodybuilder and a full-fledged, full-time runner. And you're making some compromises by doing both, but they both are supporting each other still at the same time, but you can't do both at 100%. Like, that's not the goal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you want to train for a bodybuilding show, like, you're gonna, like, maybe running isn't the best modality for your cardio. Like, it just depends, you know, so yeah. One question I thought of, and this absolutely, and it depends, but treadmill versus running on pavement. Like, do you think like people say you have access to both, right? You know, you're able, you know, have a safe neighborhood to run in or park, whatever, you got a treadmill. Like, do you think there's a benefit to doing that running on pavement, or is there like, you know, maybe starting with some treadmill runs to build up some joint, you know, stress? Is that a benefit?
So I'm not a full expert on this, but I know because of my history with injury that apparently, like, so there's slight differences in treadmill versus road, and treadmill can sometimes be, depending on how fast you're going, like the speed of what you're doing has more stress on you, but treadmill might put more stress on like your Achilles and your hips than road running and things like that. I think for some people, the treadmill is helpful because it has a controlled pace or speed, especially if they're trying to like not go too fast and they have a hard time pacing themselves. I'm of the nature of use what you can where you're at, especially if you're just starting. But if you're planning on racing or running or ever running on road, I also recommend like running on road. Also, guys, getting outside is really good for you. So like, I recommend that. Like, I know like everyone's all trying. I know you see my stories and I know you like them and you joke, and I feel like you have similar things. Like, everyone's trying to like biohack with things that like have always been accessible and free. Like, go outside and move your body outdoors. Like, you're going to feel really good if you do that. But when it comes to road versus treadmill, I would say like, use what you have where you have with what you can do. I'm a little bit pro, like if you're ever going to race or run on road, do road at least some of the time, but like I'll mix in the treadmill here and there, especially in the winter when it's icy or it's dark or it's unsafe. Like, yeah, absolutely use the treadmill, but I wouldn't use it for like 100% of your training if you're planning on doing any sort of road running or racing, or eventually move from the treadmill to the road. It's going to feel a little bit different because the belt's not automated and it's not like kind of helping you a little bit with that, you know, pacing and and moving underneath you kind of thing. It might feel a little bit different, but it's not like a, if you're just starting out, use a tool that you have, but then move towards the tool on what you need, right? Like when I'm training for trail races, like I try to make more trail miles is part of my training as I get closer to that goal. But when I'm just starting out early in the season, I don't worry so much about like, if my 10 miles on road or is it on trail? Is it on treadmill? As long as I'm getting it in, but then it gets more specific as I get closer to that goal.
Yeah. So that principle of specificity, guys, if I can say it, definitely is gonna ring true. As far as, so let's say we got, you know, the same hybrid athlete, you know, is training, you know, 3 days a week, and now we want to sign up for a 10K, let's say a 10K, but we also don't want to be last at that 10K. We want to kind of build some capacity here, maybe build in, you know, some speed or just overall like improve like our aerobic capacity. So this person isn't like having to do the walk run thing to finish, you know, the race. How would you recommend people start building their aerobic capacity, like including any like sprint work or tempo work into, you know, their training? I'll let you go off.
Yeah. So my best advice for everyone listening to this is what I would like my clients break through with it eventually. And I love it. Start training sooner than you think you need to. People, this is very human nature, and I know why people do this. They're like, that race is in 2 months, I'm gonna do it, but they're not running at all. Or they're like, that race is like, or like, it's just closer than their fitness level is at. And for some shorter stuff, like 5Ks and 10Ks, sometimes half marathons, you can like kind of get away with like, I call Barney Stinsoning your run. But if you want to enjoy it and you want to run the whole thing and you want to feel good, I recommend like, as soon as you know you want to run something, starting training, And also giving yourself maybe plenty of time to train to that goal, depending on like, if you're someone who's really poor fitness status, that's going to take longer than maybe someone who's like pretty fit, but hasn't really been running a lot in the past, right? And so one, it's going to take longer for your tendons, joints, connective tissue to adapt to that training than your cardiovascular stimulus. So you usually have to start slower and then people want. So I recommend people starting with like increasing frequency and then the volume of those days. So maybe you're starting with like 2 days a week and then you get to 3 days a week of running. For 5K, 10Ks, even half marathons, I think you can just run 3 days a week and that's fine. You can run more, but I think like 3 days a week or four is like a good place for a lot of that. And I think three is very realistic for a lot of people training for like a 5K, 10K, maybe that half doing these other things. Once you get into those higher distance races, you kind of have to just do more days to get in the volume of what you're doing. And so from there, like you're starting with your 2 days and you're spreading to three, then, you're increasing the volume of those 3 days of what you're doing, probably two easier runs and then one long run. And what I like is like bringing that volume up to where it needs to be. And it's not that you have to wait until your volume's at a certain point before you start doing speed work, but you don't want to start doing like marathon level speed workouts when you just started running recently. So maybe give yourself like 6 weeks or so to adapt to just running if you're starting from zero. Then I like starting with striders. So striders are these like short all out kind of like sprints, but they're not 100% effort. They're like 80 to 90% max running speed. So not so much like a sprint as much as it is like, it's a stride. Like it's like an all out running stride, not like a like powerful sprint. And starting with like maybe like three or four of those for 20 to 30 seconds, resting like a minute to 90 seconds in between, and then doing it for that and building up to maybe like five to six of those and doing them after your easy days. That's a great way to start like microdosing, as I like to call it, speed workout into training for people without overloading them with like a ton of high volume stress, especially when they're new and adapting. So in like my beginner runner plans, we don't do any formal speed work. We just have them build their volume and do striders because I find that that's a good happy medium for people who get really uncomfortable. Like running that novel distance and increasing that volume is already a lot on people, especially if it's their first time doing like a 10K or something like that. Running 6 miles feels like impossibly hard for you to do. And then imagine doing that and then trying to be like your fastest that you can do it at. And so I like adding striders in like 2 days a week, I think is great for a lot of people to do. But then from there, like if you have some time or you're building up or you're like, you know, you feel good, you're adapting, adding in, you don't need to have like a trillion speed workouts per week. And it doesn't need to be as much as you think it needs to be. A little bit goes a long way. So I like starting with people with like, you know, something that I really like doing is kind of like integrating like almost like tempo threshold intervals in the run. So it's like you're in the middle of a run and maybe you're doing like 2 minutes of hard effort, 3 minutes of recovery for like five rounds or something like that. And you're building it up. So you're practicing like almost surges of running harder because most people aren't going to be able to run at like their max effort pace for an extended period of time if they're just starting running because they don't even know what that is for them, right? So just starting practicing running, it's like, it's a skill. It's just like, you know, you have to practice your one rep max to improve your one rep max. Like you don't improve your one rep max just from like doing sets of 10. Mm-hmm. And so I like doing like 1 or 2 or 3 minute like efforts with like maybe equal recovery. I like doing that like my base build off-season plans because I think that those are great for people who are like trying to practice string together more. But then when we're doing like 5Ks or 10Ks and we're adding in speed workouts, you know, you can do some more formal cliche stuff like running like 200 meter repeats or 400 meter repeats or, you know, half mile repeats, things like that to practice sustained effort of your paces. The biggest thing is like, don't start, like if you Google speed workouts for like a 10K, you're going to get something that's going to tell you to do like 8 800s and you're going to blow up if you do 8 800s. Like don't do like, or 10 400s or anything like that. Start with like 2 or 3 and do that for a few weeks and then build up over time. Because especially that speed work and that intensity, that's a lot more stressful and specifically and uniquely demanding on your tissues. So you don't want to just like blow up your Achilles or your hamstring or your hips because you're just adding in a ton of explosion and high fast speeds without your body. Like that's kind of like the volume and then intensity kind of thing. Like if you start adding a whole bunch to your body, it becomes too much. And you know, that's often where people I think find themselves getting injured when they start running is because they start doing too much too soon and their body can't handle it. It's not running. It's just that you only have so much tolerance of your tissue. And that's usually where people kind of get the shin splints or the nags or the niggles that we see. And so starting with less and slowly building from there. And that's why I think, but like the shorter little intervals are fun, easy thing for people to start too. And then like fully recovering and repeating that and building up that capacity over time. Or you can do some of those fun formal speed workouts, but just don't do a ton Don't do a ton of them off the bat. Start with less, start with a few. And you'll be surprised how much speed and fitness you can gain with a low volume of speed workout. It doesn't need to be 50% of your program for it to work. And you don't necessarily have to wait, right, until you're fit enough to do it. And then the last thing that can be really helpful too is just adding in things like hills. So those striders or those some of those repeats, doing them as like long, slow hills instead can also, people joke, hills pay the bills. And I know everybody complains. They're like, I don't have hills. I live somewhere where it's flat. Oh my God. Okay, do it on a treadmill or just don't do it. Do something else. And that's totally okay too. But that's a nice way also is to like mix in like hill repeats or long, slow hills are a great way to also build speed because it kind of forces that cadence and you're working like on that uphill grade and that can help develop some speed as well.
I like that. Yeah. Florida girl would have to go find some hills, but that would be and you're like, so it would be, well, this is stupid, but like running up the hill, like, and
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of running down the hills too. You can also do downhill striders or downhill sprints. That's a technique to use too. I think a lot of people don't think you can use the downhill as the recovery or you can do it as its own repeat. I think that's very advantageous for like trail runners or people who are going to run hilly courses because that down, and I'm sure you've seen this, and like the perfect model of eccentric muscle damage and induction of soreness is downhill running.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to be running on a downhill course or you're going to be like trail running for a lot of people, you might want to do intentional downhill speed workouts. So like I just did the Grand Canyon last week, and one of the ways that I like build up my tolerance of my quads, even though I don't have a ton of big hills by me, is I found like one little hill in my neighborhood in the middle of like some of my runs, I'd go do multiple repeats, but I ran up, but I also like ran down. Like I didn't just like easy jog recovery down. I ran down to give myself that like exposure to downhill eccentric, you know, muscle damage. So that way, when I saw it again, it wasn't as novel, it didn't blow me up as much. So that is a tool and benefit too for people who are, if you're running, like, you know, you have a hilly course, try to get some hills in up and down because then your body will like, you won't be as like, oh shit, when you get to race day, right? So, and that's easier said than done. If you don't have hills, it's hard to do the down, right? But
yeah, with the treadmill, but you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Your body's more capable than you think. And I mean, like you were saying, like, I mean, I think it's just cool, like how we can adapt, right? Like we can adapt to things and like, it almost like sneaks up on you. Like even if you probably didn't do the speed work, right? Like if you just did the one long run and then maybe like, you know, two shorter runs like during the week, like you're going to get faster, you know, doing that.
And for so many people, they just, you lack, and I say this with love to the listeners, you lack aerobic fitness. Like you just lack so much aerobic fitness and it's a very slow, long thing to do. But even last year, I mean, I was injured, so I really couldn't do any speed workouts like the whole year because it was just like, and once I started running past a certain intensity, that was like my threshold of pain. So I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to like not do it because I don't want to blow up. And the fitness base I have from last year, as soon as I started adding in just like a little speed work this year, that is like, and I even got faster last year just doing that. But it's, if you do enough volume of it, enough consistently, enough over time, you know, you will get faster, especially if you're new to running, right? Eventually, like speed workouts do, like slow running does make you faster, but it doesn't make you faster on its own entirely, but it does to some degree. Like a lot of our clients just doing our beginner versions of all of our programs, they get faster just because they're running more. Like you're just doing more of it. You're going to get faster, right? Just by the act of doing it more frequently and more often. And so don't underestimate, like, don't think that you need, I think a lot of people, like, they'll come to me and they'll be like, I want a workout that's a speed workout, a tempo run, and a long run. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to give you 3 to 4 easy runs and one hard day when you've earned the volume to do that. And they're like, that's not what I want. And I'm like, well, that's what I'm going to give you. Cause that's like, that's what I think is like one of the better approaches to doing that and like building up your tolerance and your exposure over time, just like you would with anyone who's new to lifting or starting with lifting. Like you don't start on day one rep maxing your back squat. You know what I mean? Like you learn the skill of squatting, you build your volume squatting, then you start doing that higher end, higher capacity type work.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of was like progressive overload. And it's still taking me time to figure this out is like, okay, like just because you know, pulled 225.48 last week on your deadlift for the first time doesn't mean that you necessarily go to 235 next week, right? It's like you maybe adapted last week. Like maybe you had a, you know, 3 days in a row of fantastic sleep more than you normally do. And
yeah,
now it's about matching it or, you know, coming close to matching it. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And for so many people, like your running paces are going to stay the same or similar for a really long time. And you got to look for like little things, like is your heart rate lower at the same pace, or can you go faster at the same heart rate? Or is it starting to feel easier? Can you talk in full sentences? Does the effort level it takes you when going hard feel less? Like you're focused and composed, but you're not overexerted. Like these are the little things to kind of look for that people like kind of ignore because they're just like, well, my pace isn't getting easier, or I can't stay in zone two. And well, you're not gonna stay in zone two unless for like a year. So first off, unless you're on a bike or doing something easy, if you're running, it's probably gonna spike. So you're gonna have to just keep with it or to see those benefits. Cause if you give up, you know, or try to get like progressively increase your pace or distance every single week. I think that's a big mistake a lot of beginners make too, is they think that every single week they're going to increase like their long run by like a mile into oblivion. But every time you do like a long run or new distance, that's hard, and not, you don't just adapt instantly. You adapt by doing it repeatedly over and over again, or having more mileage across the week. Like people put too much weight on like just the long run. They think like that is what's making or breaking my training. And you're like, no, it's all the running across the week. And it's every time you expose yourself to that long run distance and you get fitter every time you do that stimulus over time, right? Like you're going to get stronger. Even if you did 225 for 8 3 weeks in a row, probably what you lift a month after that is because you did that 3 weeks in a row and you let your body get the chance to adapt to that. And it felt easier. And it's the same thing for running.
Yeah. It's like, you can do it all, just maybe not all at once sometimes. And that's fitness, that's life. And God, like you have some videos on like zone two training, right? And like pacing.
I have it all.
Okay. I'm going to link that in the show notes because we don't have time to get into that today. Yes. But definitely check that out. But I did want to ask you, because I mean, you do a shit ton, like as a professional, as an athlete, you have a huge reach on Instagram, and I know that comes with a lot too. But have you found like in your own journey, like different strategies or like mindset shifts to help you quote unquote balance it all? Anything you can kind of like, you know, I mean, selfishly, I can take away, you know, too, even.
Yeah. No, it's funny because I was just at a conference and I was like, you know, the more and more knowledgeable I get and the more I get viewed as an expert, the less people ask me about like me as a human. And I'm like, I actually feel like I have more to offer now of like human advice than I did 5 years ago in the middle of my PhD when everyone was asking me, how are you balancing it? Like, no one asked me that anymore because I think they just like, they're like, you're insane.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's funny because it's like, in the beginning of my PhD, a big reason I started doing ultras is because I felt so mentally weak. I was like, oh my God, I can't, like, I just had like so much self-doubt and so much imposter syndrome and so much insecurity and so much lack of confidence. And just, I don't know, like, and for me, like a big thing was just like repeatedly doing hard things outside my comfort zone made those my comfort zone, right? So like, it's funny now, the things that I do years ago would have left me into like a complete spiral, and I feel them being natural or less stressful, or it's just like, oh, this is just what I do. And so for one, I think just doing the hard stuff that's uncomfortable or that you suck at, and like getting really close and comfortable and okay with failure. Like a PhD is just learning how to fail repeatedly until someone gets to say you're a doctor, right? And so learning how to like fuck around and find out and do things before they're perfect or they're ready or they're messy, and like growing my business even by doing it in my PhD, like that really taught me like you don't have the time to wait till it's perfect. You just got to do and refine and go. And so for me, that was huge. But then with doing it all now, I mean, I'm known as the boundaries girl, but I have to have boundaries or I'm going to die. I'm going to explode. Saying no, especially social media. I had like a really bad breaking point a few years ago because like the amount of, you know, people are listening to this, I think followers get like offended or upset when you talk about this, but the amount of demands and asks and questions and requests, like sometimes I get 700 messages a week. Like it's nuts. Like I can't, like that's a bad week, but like, that's a lot. Like that's crazy. And it's feels like you're like disappointing everyone. And everyone wants something from you. And like, even professionally, people, I'm getting asked more and more and more stuff all the time. And you're like, how do I decide what's worth my time, what to say yes to? And I think like for me, a lot of it's just been trial and error, figuring out, oh, I overdid it. Oh, I did too much. Oh, okay. No, I need to shift this boundary and move it up. I don't say yes to these things anymore, or I don't say, or I'm limiting my time and availability on this kind of thing. And for me, it's always been a trial of error of like, I'm the queen of pushing my limits. I joke, I'm Icarus. I fly too close to the sun. And so for
to.
Me, it
was, you have to though. Yeah, in my opinion.
And that's how I figured it out. And so at some degree I've accepted that, like, it just, the more and more I become successful in business and professionally, the more and more, like, I have to just give up a lot of other things. Like, it was a lot easier when I wasn't great at everything that I was doing. It was like, looking back, it felt harder. I don't, like, if I had to restart my business again and redo my PhD, I don't honestly know if I have anything to do that. But there was a lot more flexibility and freedom there, where now there's a lot more pressure and it feels a lot more serious. And so ironically, it feels like I have a lot less time. And so I just have to be like really protective of myself. But what's been helpful by doing the hard things and getting over that, like, I reached a point in the middle of my PhD and even towards the end in the last few years where I just like got the fuck, I just got so sick of my internal narrative. I'm like, Alyssa, how many fucking times do you have to show yourself that you do everything well and everything great and you show up and you know who you are before you just like get over this? I just got like sick of myself. I got sick of this. Like, I'm like, okay, like, I'm annoyed by myself. I just got sick of it. I was just like, you're not, like, you haven't fucked anything up. You do everything well. You always show up. Like, I just didn't have the bandwidth for my own shit anymore and my own head drama. I just got over it. But it also helped because I showed myself and I gave myself proof over and over again. And I think that you sometimes you're nervous or you don't know how to do something or you don't know if you can do something or you don't know if you can manage all these things. And like, the only way you find out is by doing it. Like, people are waiting for the perfect time, the perfect opportunity, or when they're ready. I can tell you right now, I'm not even ready for this next chapter of it's like, it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop getting uncomfortable and it doesn't stop forcing you to grow. And it doesn't stop forcing you to reestablish your boundaries or question what you value. You just have to get more confident in knowing what's right and best for you. And then also, like, you need to be your biggest cheerleader. You need to believe in yourself. You need to see the vision and the dream and the goal before anyone else. Cause it's funny now because nobody asks me these questions anymore because it's just what I'm doing, but they didn't see the years of like sucking at it or being bad at it or how hard it was or how scary it was, you know, to kind of get to that point. And so recognizing that the people doing everything well, or doing everything, you're seeing the hero's end of the journey. You're seeing the now, you're not seeing everything that went into this. But really, when it comes to balancing and doing a lot, if you're multi-passionate or you want to do a lot of things and careers in your life, it's like, you have to get like kind of really selfish, right? You have to be selfish in the sense of like, you have to protect your time. You have to know when to say no. And I'm still learning this. I'm not great at it. I overextend myself a lot too, but you also have to be willing to come across as arrogant because you have to believe in yourself and you have to be confident in what you're doing and you have to believe in it before anyone else believes in it, because nobody believed in my vision when I quit my first PhD program and I said, I'm going to start a business and I'm going to start training ultra marathons. I was none of those things when I, like, 5 years ago, right? Or 6 years ago now, whenever that was. But now I'm those things and no one questions it. But at the time, I was the only one who like saw and believed that. And you just have to, like, you have to be your biggest fan and in your corner, but you also have to be your biggest protector. And you have to get okay with disappointing people, because that's the thing that sucks, especially if you're like people pleasing. I know a lot of females can be that way, or you don't want to like burn bridges on the way to the top or what you're doing. But at some point in time, like, you have to protect your peace and your energy. So my example is like, if I can't give my husband the attention he deserves, your DM doesn't get it before that. Like, that's the kind of mindset and attitude I had to start to shift, because I was overextending myself for years. Or like, you know, even setting boundaries with myself, like, you're done working at this time. Mm-hmm. You are doing this today. Like, that's helped me a lot too, because I'm a workaholic. I went through a massive stage of burnout from my PhD in my business. And I think seeing how unhealthy that made me was the scariest thing I ever saw in my life. My fitness tanked, my health tanked, my hair was falling out, my skin was a mess, my gut was a mess. And I was like, never again. I'm never going to give that much of myself to other people. To the point that I literally was like, I was losing bits of myself. So that, I mean, I went too far, right? And so sometimes you have to do that though. I don't know if I ever regret how hard I worked or how much I did in my 20s, but now that I'm in my 30s, I want to keep advancing, but I don't want to lose myself along the way within that. And that's been more of a delicate balance in the last year or two for me. It's like, okay, well, how do I keep doing what I want to do, doing all the things without also completely losing myself in the process? And so I'll round this out of my last bit of advice. Have fun. I think in the world of social media and the biohacking and the success hacking, everyone's like, I wake up at 5 a.m. and I journal and meditate and I don't use social media and I go on a walk and stare in the sun and make a perfect 5-step adrenal cocktail, blah, 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 blah. And then like, it's just like, be social, have fun, go outside, laugh, dance, be silly. Like, those are also huge things. Like, I think when you're burnt out or you're overextended, like one, think about where you're giving too much of yourself to other people and you're not giving enough back to yourself. And think about like, not about what, sometimes it is about what you need to give up or do less of, but what do you need to be doing more of that fills you up? So I'm incredibly protective of like my training or my traveling or the things that I love and value, because that's what adds fulfillment to my life. Like, even though I'm stressed at the wazoo, because last week I took the later half of the week off to go to the Grand Canyon, I'm also more fulfilled because I spent a day in the Grand Canyon and I went on a trip with my friends, or I was outdoors. Like, that stuff fulfills me, and you have to build that into your life, because the work will fill your life if you do not build the things that you want to be doing or you value into your life. And like, getting really firm with your own boundaries with yourself. Like, I was crossing my own boundaries for years, and you have to be like, no, you're doing this at this time. You have to go do this. You're taking time off for this. You have to make sure you put life into your work, because you don't want your work to become your life. And that, you know, those are the, I'm sure when I'm 40, I'll look back and think about all the things I'm fucking up now and doing wrong and the advice I'd give myself. But that in the last like 6 years, that's really been my progress with all of these things. Cause it's like 6 years ago, I was none of the things that I am. And now I'm a whole bunch of things, and it's scary and overwhelming, and you can let it kind of, you know, destroy you, or you can let it kind of empower you. I guess you kind of can make that choice.
Love that. I had questions and you answered them as you continue to kind of explain, you know, your just journey to get here. And like you said, yeah, like 10 years from now, it'll look different, but that's being a human. And yeah, not worshiping the mighty should is what I heard somebody say one time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that definitely hit for me. And fun. Yeah. Like, do you love that 12-step morning routine? Like, is that fun for you? Then hell yeah. But like, if it's not, like, put it aside, like, you know, and we're going to have to do things that aren't fun for us. Like, that's part of life. But yeah. So, well, I did want to end on some rapid fire questions for fun, to get to know you a little bit better. So I have three for you. So number one, what do you listen to on your long runs?
I listen to a lot of music. So I do listen to, on long runs, I usually do 1 or 2 hours of podcast depending on the run, but then eventually my brain just doesn't want to focus. Mm-hmm. So I like a lot of like, I'll do a lot of like Dirtbag Diaries, or I like Rich Roll's podcast, but I listen to like the interviews of people, or outside magazines like stories, or sometimes NPR's like nerdy stuff. I'm not really good at podcasts, even though I'm on them and I have my own. I don't want to freaking learn a damn thing when I'm running. I know that I could be so much more knowledgeable if I spent more time learning on my runs, but you know what I do all day? I consume and create information. I don't want to do that. So I like listening to people's stories, but I'm a huge music junkie. So I listen to a ton of music when I'm running. And like, that's, I mean, sometimes I just listen to only music when I'm running, because I'm just like, I'm here to like cleanse my brain. So.
Any concerts on the agenda this year, or music festivals?
I technically have tickets to Odessa in Washington, but I haven't booked the flight yet. So who knows if we'll actually make it out there. We're trying to see the National again, but they're kind of expensive. But nothing else yet. I know. Normally I'm a big concert. I do a lot of concerts. I just haven't found anything that's like a date and time that works for me. There's a few things out there, but like, I'm gone. So I'm like, well, I guess I'm not doing that. So I did a lot when I was in Colorado. I feel like I went to like a bajillion concerts, and even Athens, but I haven't been to quite as many. So hopefully more this year. Hopefully I'll make it out to Washington for that Odessa concert too.
Yeah, I heard that was good. Okay, last question. Only one post long real month long. Okay, let me do it again. Only one post long run meal for the rest of your life. What are you going to have?
Oh my God. Probably Chipotle. I feel like I'm known as the post run Chipotle girl. That or a massive burger and fries. Either Chipotle or massive burger and fries. That's the Alyssa special.
Solid. Awesome. I love it. Well, I really appreciate your time today. I mean, I got a lot of good takeaways, and I know your YouTube is just full of awesome information for people. You have your own podcast, but where's the best place for people to find you?
Yeah. So I hang out the most on Instagram. I'm really trying to grow my YouTube though, so please go check that out. Dockless Fitness on Instagram, docklessfitness.com, Dockless Fitness on YouTube. My podcast is called The Messy Middle. It's like the one thing that isn't Dockless Fitness. Go figure that. And yeah, you can find all of my stuff, all the things all the places. I've got ton more information on female phys. I got a ton more information on hybrid training, cardio. I have ebooks that I highly recommend if you just want to like cut to the chase and just get the information like direct, like instead of just like jimmy rigging together things for my content, right? Usually that's what I suggest. I'm like, just get the ebook because it's just going to tell you directly what to do. So yeah, Dockless Fitness across the board. Find me on Instagram and everything will be linked from there.
Sweet. Well, we will see you there. And again, I appreciate it. You guys, if you liked this episode, be sure to share it on your Instagram stories, tag us, leave a review, all that fun stuff. And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, guys.